Welcome to Lexis, the podcast all about language and linguistics. I'm Lisa Casey.
I'm Jackie Glancy.
I'm Raj Rana.
And I'm Dan Clayton. Okay, so on this episode of Lexis, we're delighted to welcome Professor Emily M. Bender, who's Professor of Linguistics at the University of Washington. So welcome, Emily. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
And you are a computational linguist. So our first question really is, you know, as a term, that seems to sort of combine two areas that might not necessarily seem to go together naturally. You know, so something about numbers and machines, something about communication and humans. Is it fair to say there's a tension between computers and linguistics?
It depends on what level you're looking at. I would say that there's a lot of linguistics that's very mathematical. In fact, there's this wonderful line in the movie Arrival where the main character, who's a linguist, is, you know, her love interest is this physicist. And he says, wow, you do language, but with math, or something along the lines. And unfortunately, what she doesn't say, and she should, is, well, that's basically the job description. So a lot of linguistics really is about looking at languages as formal systems, and computers are very much about manipulating formal systems. So in that way, they go hand in hand very well. In other ways, certainly, if you want to get into the more sort of socially relevant parts of linguistics, looking at how language variation maps onto social structures, how people manipulate and use language to express their ideas, but also their personae, there you might feel like the sort of cut and dried computation about it kind of misses the point. And there I think we resolve that tension by making sure that the use of computers is in the service of doing the research that is driven by the linguistic and sociolinguistic questions rather than the other way around.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that when you use computers for linguistics, I suppose things like corpus linguistics would be a kind of very clear application of that.
Yeah.
Do you think they kind of provide you with tools that you wouldn't otherwise have?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of my research is in grammar engineering, and that is, you know, building grammars in software that the computer can manipulate, but the human can also understand. And what that lets us do is test our grammatical analyses across way larger collections of examples than you could ever do by hand. So that's one way that I like to use computers in linguistics.
So for many people listening, large language models and perhaps generative AI will be fairly familiar in the form of something like ChatGPT. How do they work, and what are the principles behind large language models?
Yeah.
That's quite a big question, I think.
It's a big question, but I can give you a short-ish answer. The very short answer is they're an enormous parlor trick that plays on our ability to quickly, instinctively, reflexively make sense of language when we come to it. The slightly longer answer is, at a fundamental level, they work the same way as autocorrect on your phone. It's the same technology. It is a computational representation of the distribution of word forms in some very large corpus of text. In the case of something like ChatGPT, it is an undisclosed corpus of text. We don't know what all is in there. Although I understand that the just passed EU AI Act is going to start putting in some requirements along those lines, which is super exciting. You know, I haven't read the details, but I'm hopeful. And so what these systems are doing is basically the training setup is, here's a whole bunch of text. The system is made to make a guess about a missing word or the next word, and then that guess is compared to what word was actually uttered. And when it's correct, fine. When it's different, then the parameters in the system are updated to make the thing that was actually the answer a little bit more likely, and the thing that was output instead a little bit less likely, and so on, iteratively over and over and over again. It's just manipulating the form of the language. What happens at the scale of something like ChatGPT, because it's trained on such a large corpus, and because in the training they've done this extra layer of what's called reinforcement learning from human feedback, where they had raters go through and give scores to the output so that the system is not only trying to come up with what's a likely next word, but what's a likely next word that would also score high in this rating. And the result of all that is it is able to produce very polished, fluent, human-seeming text. And when that text is put in front of us, we can't help but use our own linguistic capacity to make sense of it. But that sense-making capacity fundamentally relies on imagining a mind behind the text. With other people, that works well. With the machine, there isn't one.
And I guess that does sort of tap into that idea, doesn't it, in sociolinguistics, where, you know, we get people talking a lot about things like accent and intelligibility. And they always assume that it's kind of like a one-way process, that it's the fault of the person who doesn't, you know, he's using the language. And a lot of sociolinguists kind of say, well, actually, communication is a two-way street, isn't it? It's about the listener as well as the person producing the sounds. You're kind of saying that with large language models, we as listeners are kind of over-interpreting what we're being given because we want to seek out some sort of human connection with the language.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. And the way the systems have been designed by the companies selling them absolutely leans into that. So there's no reason that ChatGPT should use first-person pronouns because there's no I in there. Mm-hmm. But it's been built to do that. And then we encounter that and interpret it because that's what we do naturally with our language.
Yeah. And you say they're trained on language. What kind of data are we talking about here?
Well, unfortunately, not very much is known. It's large. At the core is probably something called Common Crawl, which is this project that collects a bunch of data from URLs on the internet and makes a first pass at trying to avoid things that are just generated text in the first place, trying to avoid things that are maybe the dark web, like the Common Crawl, I think makes a first attempt at getting so-called good parts of the internet. I believe one of the things that they do is taking links that were posted to Reddit. So not the text on Reddit necessarily, but the URLs that showed up on Reddit, because that's a sign that some person thought this was a useful web page. And so it's a good URL to go crawl. One of the things I like to tell people is that if someone tells you ChatGPT or some other large language model is trained on the whole internet, that's a red flag that they don't know what they're talking about, because there is no place where you can go download the whole internet. It's distributed. You have to make some decisions about what you're crawling and what you're collecting. Mm-hmm. And so far, OpenAI has been completely closed-lipped about what that is.
Right.
So we have no idea really where huge swathes of this language is coming from, really, do we?
Yeah, exactly. The Common Crawl is documentable, and there's some work by Jesse Dodge and others going through and documenting it, but we don't know what else they've got. They did mention in some of their tech reports that they basically hired people to generate conversations, because one of the big differences between ChatGPT and its predecessor GPT-3 is that it's conversational. Well, you're not going to find that much conversational data just sort of sitting there in text on the internet, so they had to make some. But can we go look at what they've made? No, it's all closed. It's all their own, you know, private IP.
And I guess more broadly, sort of away from just ChatGPT, there's perhaps that kind of sense in which, you know, there's been quite a lot of concern, hasn't there, about the access that large language models have to copyrighted material, you know, individuals' own work, what we've sort of signed our rights away to already, to things like, say, WordPress or, you know, Blogger or anything that we put out there and created ourselves. Is that a concern as well with large language models?
It's a huge concern. So both the sort of creative control and compensation and credit for your work, but also I believe that DocuSign is also looking to sell their data. That's a whole bunch of sensitive documents.
Right? I signed one of those this morning for my AQA contract.
Because I sign those all the time. I don't even think about it.
Right. And you know, when we talk about WordPress and DocuSign selling data, it doesn't necessarily mean that they've sold all the data. There might be some things that are treated differently than others, but still the fact that they're selling any of it is really troubling.
So, you know, what would you say are the most significant biases at work in large language models then, and how can they be addressed?
Yeah. So I want to go back to some work by Batya Friedman and Helen Nissenbaum from the late 1990s, where they categorize the biases in technology in general into three buckets. The first one is pre-existing bias. So that is bias in the world that is reproduced in the technology. And that's where we're going to find most of it in large language models. There's also emergent bias, which is when something that's created in one context is then deployed in another and it doesn't work as well. And we can see some of that. And then the third one is technical bias, where there's some decisions that you make that just end up cutting things out that are sort of technical decisions. And their example for technical bias is if you decide to alphabetize something and then a person comes to the system and they're looking at alphabetical lists of people where therefore the people whose last names start in the beginning of the alphabet are going to get considered first, for example. That's a technical bias. Another technical bias is you sometimes hit systems where people have decided that the name field can't have any white space in it. You're not allowed to use spaces in names. And then that becomes a problem for anybody whose name has a space in it. Right. So those are technical biases. And I know fewer of those in the language model space. The pre-existing bias one is huge, right? So these things are trained on large collections of text. We don't know exactly what, but we do know that whenever we speak or write, our views of the world are encoded in our word choice. And this is things like actually saying slurs versus saying lots of negative things without using slur words about a particular group of people. Or there's also things that don't necessarily come across as negative in the first instance. But if you see, for example, the bigram woman doctor, and you never see the bigram man doctor, that sort of sets up the expectation that it's unusual for a doctor to be a woman, even though it's not true in the modern age. So all of these patterns are encoded in the language that we use that's then used to train these systems. And what is machine learning? Well, it's basically just pattern matching at scale. And so these systems are going to ingest these patterns and then reproduce them. And there's a scholar, Abeba Berhane, who makes the really important point that using machine learning over historical data is an inherently conservative process, in the sense that that's saying that the pattern from the past should be replicated into the future. Mm-hmm. And if we want to do something different to that, then we have to think about what the patterns are that we are inputting into the system and then how we're using them in the world.
No, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So that's the pre-existing bias, which is going to get in there. This interacts with another kind of bias called automation bias, which is when people interact with machines, the machines seem objective, they seem capable, they seem to have more information than we do. And so we are likely to believe the machines. And when you put those things together, it's quite pernicious, right? You have this seemingly objective system coming back with all of the worst of our subjective biases. I just want to get to the emergent bias case, which is if you take something that is trained on English from one community, and then you make it available to another community, it's not going to work as well for them. And this includes things like automatic transcription, sometimes called automatic speech recognition, which is typically designed for a few English varieties and then just is not going to work as well for other English varieties. And, you know, where did it start? Did it start with the most widely spoken varieties of English? Did it start, for example, with Indian English? Of course not, right? We started with the English from California. And the further your variety is from the English as spoken by white middle or upper class people in California, the longer it takes for there to be usable speech recognition systems for you.
That's a whole bundle of bias. And when you kind of think, I mean, one of the arguments I've often seen, and I don't think it's even, you know, you could take this as a good faith argument if you like, but I think it's probably bad faith behind it, is when people turn around and say things like, well, how can these things be biased? They're computers, they're not humans, you know, but of course the data that they're gathering and the data that they're working on is all human generated, all of the human biases across human history.
Yeah, and that exactly is a statement of automation bias.
Yeah,
The claim that computers can't be biased is a statement of automation bias.
Yeah, and I guess the sources they use as well. I mean, we were just talking before about how the dictionaries, you know, Oxford English Dictionary is going back through its data, you know, it has done for a long time, but it increasingly is doing that because they're aware, they're conscious of the fact that lots of the data they had before came from particular sources, which they might have privileged because they were certain kinds of English that were taken from certain kinds of documents, which maybe were only available for certain groups of people, you know, white, upper class, privileged males generally to produce. And of course, that's not an accurate reflection of the language that's been used around the world for, you know, tens of thousands of years. So the kind of sources that this stuff is trained on will be a problem in the first instance, won't they?
Yeah. I mean, if you're talking about English, you don't go back tens of thousands of years, but your point is valid.
Yeah, true. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But the next step that sometimes people take is, okay, so how can we come up with an unbiased training set, or how can we de-bias a model? And the answer is you can't completely. That no matter what data you've collected, it's never going to be fully representative. And there's always going to be decisions that you have to make. And so the thing is to do your best, right? To try to make something that's representative and inclusive, and to recognize that it's not perfect. And then to reason through how that's going to impact how the technology will be used and will fail in certain cases. And one of the proposals that I have is connected to data set documentation. So the idea is that not only should we be thoughtful about curating our data sets, but we have to publish that information. What's in there? Where did it come from? Whose language use is this, right? What is the linguistic background of the people who did any annotation? So sometimes in these systems, it's not just lots and lots of text, but text with certain answers associated with it. Who were those people, right? What is their positionality? And making all of that accessible to anybody who might decide to use the system, or to anybody who might have a system used on them, is really important for accountability and redress.
I guess with the increasing uses of large language models and AI in things like, you know, border control, about, you know, things around accent and dialect. We've seen there's a paper I'll link to in the show notes that talked about sort of dialect prejudice against African-American vernacular English. You know, there's increasing worries that, you know, already marginalized groups will be, you know, affected adversely by the use of this technology.
Yeah. And I wish I had the reference for you, but there was some reports of border control somewhere. Don't know if it was us or if it was you, using automated systems. Actually, it may have even been Germany, to do language classification. What is the language these people are speaking, as a way of basically saying to these asylum seekers, you have to prove to us that you are the right kind of person. And if our automated system doesn't agree that you speak whatever language variety we think you should for your story to be believable to us, then we're not going to let you in. And if you think about the people who are in one of the most vulnerable positions that's possible to be in, being asylum seekers, having to prove their linguistic capacity to somebody who has no knowledge of the language that they are insisting this person must speak to be valid, but is relying on a machine, that's a terrible position to be in, and a completely unethical use of the technology.
That might be the one you mentioned, Raj, before, wasn't it?
Yeah, Reid, just kind of thinking about how all sorts of prejudices are kind of reinforced through these aspects. And it's kind of completely ignoring, isn't it, the sense that individual speakers come with their own linguistic repertoire. So regardless of where you're from, you know, we haven't really got the ideal model of point of origin for language, if you like. You know, we've got all these different kind of social class, gender, educational influences that have really impacted our language, regardless of our point of origin. And yet there's this machine that is making all these judgments on the basis of what they think our language should be.
So it's a very clear case where this is not an appropriate use of automation, that you can always get, machine learning systems will always give you some answer. And so it's extra important to make sure that you know, okay, what is it making this decision based on? Why is it appropriate to use in this case or not? And what are its failure modes? Like how often is it incorrect? And how do we provide recourse for somebody who has been affected by a decision based on an incorrect output from the machine?
So what are your criticisms of the term artificial intelligence? And why is that an important conversation to have?
Yeah. So you'll notice that I don't use the phrase artificial intelligence without putting scare quotes around it. Similarly for AI, generative AI, all of those, they come with scare quotes for me, because I think that it muddies the waters. The technologies that are getting sold as artificial intelligence are not a coherent set of technologies. But by calling them artificial intelligence, two things happen. One is that it links the technologies in people's minds to the depictions of artificial intelligence in science fiction, when we don't have anything like HAL or Data or the operating system from HER or all of these things. But those ideas exist in our cultural imagination, or Marvin, right? From Douglas Adams.
Yeah, paranoid
Android. Yeah. So those ideas and characters exist for us. And so the label artificial intelligence connects them. And it also connects all of these disparate technologies. So ChatGPT, which seems intelligent because we make sense of its output, then gets to extend that veneer of intelligence, of seeming intelligence, to automatic decision systems, for example, these things that might be used to decide whether or not an asylum seeker's language is appropriate, right? Well, if ChatGPT is quote AI and this is quote AI and ChatGPT seems really smart, then this thing must also work. That's part of the issue.
Just sort of slight diversion into another sort of field, because I think kind of looking at large language models, I think maybe one of the first times I ever really came across them without even knowing what they were was around neural networks and connectionist models that child language researchers were using, maybe in the late 80s, early 90s, was it? Something around that time. So they, you know, linguists have been interested in those kind of things, haven't they?
Yeah.
For a while. I mean, are they getting any closer using those to an understanding of how early children's language develops, or is it actually only going to reveal part of the answer?
Yeah. So yes, I think there is interesting research happening there, and yes, it will only be part of the answer. So we're talking about how artificial intelligence is a misleading term. I think neural networks is also misleading because the individual neurons, in quotes, in the neural networks are just mathematical functions.
Yeah.
And it's a simplified version of a 1940s understanding of how neurons work. So to say this is like an artificial brain is mistaking the model for something that it isn't. But the name of it definitely encourages that mistake. I think that what is interesting in child language acquisition research that uses connectionist models, neural nets, and the sort of large language models. So large language models don't have to be built on neural nets, right? The Claude Shannon's work in the 1940s was language modeling that was not involving these so-called neural models. It's just that the ones that we have now do. And the thing about a language model is that it is manipulating only the form of language. And the fact that the language models can get really fine-grained syntactic information out of a large enough corpus puts interesting constraints on the discussion of what can and can't be learned from form alone. On the other hand, the way that infants actually acquire language has nothing to do with the way that large language models are trained. So large language models do this repetitive guess the missing word, guess the missing word, guess the missing word over enormous amounts of text with no interaction with another entity with communicative intent and no access to what communicative intent might be behind the text that they're manipulating. Babies, on the other hand, are in very rich situated communicative experiences. And there's research showing that what's absolutely key to getting started with your first language is something called joint attention and intersubjectivity, where the baby and the caregiver are attending to the same thing and mutually aware of that fact. So yes, there's interesting things to be learned by running computer simulations of processing text. But in order to make those learnings relevant to the study of child language acquisition, we have to keep a very clear sense of where the models are extremely simplified, if not just completely orthogonal to what's going on with actual human babies.
Yeah. So great for syntax, but not a lot else.
Yeah. So Shane Steinert-Threlkeld, who's one of my colleagues here at the University of Washington, does interesting things looking at the development of artificial languages and things like quantifiers and semantics. But there, the models tend to be artificial agents interacting with each other. So it's a different thing where there's possibly some access to a very stylized notion of meaning.
So you present a podcast called Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000 with Alex Hanna, where you dissect the corporate and media hype around AI, the exaggerated and outlandish claims around AI. What would you say are the most prevalent discourses around AI at the moment, and why should we be skeptical of them?
Yeah. So thank you for this question and for the chance to talk about our podcast. And I just want to say it's an accidental podcast. So if some of your listeners want to come listen, I appreciate that. Just be aware the sound quality is really shaky in the start. We get better. So the most prevalent discourses around AI in the AI hype, there's two. One is the AI boosters. AI is going to solve everything. We are, months away from a system that we can just ask to cure cancer and it'll go away and come back with the cure for cancer. Right. And we're months away from a system that will solve the environmental crisis for us. That's the AI booster version. And the most pernicious sort of iterations of that have to do with saying, look, we can use so-called AI to do therapy because there isn't enough access to mental health services. We can use it as tutors because there isn't enough access to education. We can use it to help people with their medical questions, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Which we can't, right? And the people who are selling this will then turn around and say, and there's a senior person at Google, I'm sorry, Alex is the one who's got his name down, who's in charge of Google Health, who said that he would never want this kind of thing to be part of his own family's healthcare journey, but maybe it could be useful for other people. So right. Extremely pernicious, as used basically as an excuse to do more and more austerity and to shirk our social responsibilities and shred the social safety net. So that's the AI booster narrative. The other narrative is the AI doomer narrative, that somehow if we make these things just a little bit bigger, they are going to combust into consciousness and then they are going to become evil machines like Skynet and decide to wipe out humanity. And we better put a whole bunch of effort into convincing regulators to slow down the development of AI so that doomsday scenario doesn't come about. This is also problematic because it's basically saying the same thing. These systems are super powerful. It's just saying it by saying they're so powerful, we should be scared of them. And it's pernicious because rather than focusing policymaker attention on making sure that we have clarity about the training data, making sure that companies can't come in and steal people's own creative output in order to train these systems, making sure that anytime we have automation in play in social services, there's recourse for people who are adversely affected. All of these things that we would like our policymakers looking at, instead, they're spending time thinking about the doomsday scenario. So these are the two discourses. And they also like to set themselves up in opposition to each other as if that's the whole universe, as if you're a doomer, you're a booster, and any other position has to fall in between the two, when in fact, they're off in their own bubble in outer space, so far away from reality, and it's tiny compared to the range of things we should be thinking about as the negative impacts of this technology. And the negative impacts of this technology, not so much the technology itself, but how it's built and how it's used.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I guess, like a lot of discourses, the metaphors are quite appealing, aren't they, as a way of articulating something about an issue that's quite complex to understand. You know, I guess most of us would have no real idea what goes on inside the black box, but a metaphor makes it seem much more straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's another thing about the AI doomer discourse, which is it interacts with privilege in interesting ways. So if you want to engage with the actual harms that are happening to people now, those harms are not equally distributed. They are going to land first on people who are already experiencing more oppression. So if your language variety is not well recognized, well, you probably speak a stigmatized language variety, right? If you are getting misrecognized in an automatic facial recognition system being used by the police department somewhere and then arrested falsely, probably you belong to a community that is already over-surveilled and over-policed. If you are having, you know, to deal with very exploitative labor conditions in creating some of that fine-tuning data for ChatGPT, has happened with these workers in Kenya, looking at really traumatic output for poor pay with no psychological support, you aren't sitting on top of a whole lot of privilege if you ended up taking that job, right? In order to engage with these issues, people who have privilege have to grapple with the fact of their privilege and grapple with sort of their own position in what's going on. In order to spend time worrying about, you know, a large language model turning into Skynet and killing us all, you don't have to do any of that, right? Because it's going to happen to everybody, even those with the most privilege.
And it's not as if we're not doing a good enough job of destroying the human race ourselves, even without computers, is it?
So. Exactly right. So as we're grappling with the climate crisis, it's definitely a good idea to put more and more compute cycles and fresh water into building these large language models with no clear purpose, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, back to the Mystery AI Hype Theater 3000 podcast, we definitely take that sort of snarky, sarcastic tone to a lot of things. And it's fun, weirdly. Yeah. Like, we're going after really rough topics, but we try to do it with a sense of humor and build a sense of community, because with so much AI hype around, it's often easy to feel like you're the only one who hasn't jumped on that bandwagon.
Yeah.
And that can feel lonely. So part of our purpose with that podcast is to try to build a community and help people know that they're not alone in wondering why everyone's gotten so excited about these synthetic media extruding machines.
Yes. So it's kind of emperor new clothes kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Brilliant. Right. Okay. Let's move on to the quick fire questions. So what's your favorite book about language?
Yeah, so I have two speculative fiction books to recommend to you that I've read relatively recently. One is Babel by R.F. Kuang.
I love that book.
It's such a great book. And the way that the magic works in that world is just like perfect for a linguist's enjoyment. And the book is lovely in many, many other ways, but I really enjoy that. And then the other one is a series in which the first novel is called A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin. And what I really love there is it's a, you know, space opera sort of a thing where you have the main character lives on a space station, but they are the ambassador from that space station to a planet. And it has a very realistic depiction of the experience of being an outsider who's studied very hard and done a lot to master the language of the community that you're visiting, but will always feel a bit of an outsider in your language use. So I really enjoyed that about that book.
That sounds great.
So what's your favorite linguistic fact or idea?
Yeah, I hesitated between two, but the one that I think I want to give you is the way pronouns work in American Sign Language. So in English, we use pronouns that tell us something about person, number, and gender. So we distinguish between first, second, and third person. And then we have singular versus plural. If we're talking first or third person, we've lost the distinction in the second person, right? We just have you. Third person, we have gender. So you can say he, you can say she, you can say they, you can say it. Those are all different third person pronouns with different genders. And we use that in conversation to give just tiny little clues as to which referent this pronoun is picking up. So you can use a pronoun for a referent that is sufficiently in focus in the discussion that that little bit of information about person, number, gender is enough to for your interlocutor to track who you're referring to. In American Sign Language, what happens is the signers use the signing space and they indicate a spot in that space and associate it with a referent. And they just keep pointing back to that spot for as long as that referent is being referred to with that pronoun. So first person, you point yourself. Second person, you point to the person or people you're talking to. But third person pronouns get assigned arbitrary spots in the signing space. And then that means you can have lots of them, which is really cool.
That's really interesting. Right. What one bit of advice would you give a budding linguist? It'd be difficult to narrow that down to one.
Yeah, I think I am going to give you two on this one. They're related, though. So the first one is to take a really broad view of what linguistics is. And Wes Leonard likes to say linguistics is a science of language. He does amazing work bringing Indigenous perspectives into linguistics, basically helping the field of linguistics along by adding to it with these richer perspectives or an additional set of perspectives. So what's happened, at least stateside, is we went from a very closed view of what counts as linguistics to, I think, a period now of opening up and seeing the study of language in many different viewpoints as legitimately linguistics. And so I would say take a very broad view. And as you try, you know, in that broad view, reading things from across different language sciences, my word of advice to someone reading an academic paper is that reading an academic paper is usually about, I had a pithier way of saying this. I sometimes see students coming to papers feeling like they have to understand everything in the paper, that if you've successfully read a paper, you have gotten everything the author wanted you to know. But in fact, the way that I like to read academic papers, and I think the way that most successful academics do, is they go into a paper trying to see if that paper answers a specific question that they have, and if so, how the paper answers it. And so some things might be more or less in focus, and you might come back to a paper with a different question and get something out of it on a different read. But that sort of, I'm looking at this paper to see if I can answer a specific question, makes academic literature much more approachable and makes it easier to do that sort of broader reading where you are going a bit outside your expertise or maybe a lot outside your expertise to get a sense of what's out there.
No, that's really good advice. I think for the sort of age group we teach as well, I think those kind of papers seem so far away from their own experience of what they've read that having a different approach to it and having that sort of question approach seems to be a really good bit of advice.
But it's yes, I think especially as you're starting out, I mean, I still do that, right? I've been studying linguistics since 1992 and yeah. I still look at papers that way.
Brilliant. No, thanks very much. That's great.
This has been a lovely conversation and I'm really glad to get to speak to your audience.
Thanks very much. Well, cheers for doing it and I'm sure they'll get a lot out of it.
Hope so.